right, for our last presentation of this session, and before we'll break for something different, we're going to hear from Melanie Davis. She's a project coordinator with the USGS for 5 years, and she is currently wrapping up her PhD at University of Washington. Research focuses on post-restoration monitoring efforts in several restoring estuaries, including the Nisqually River Delta, which we'll hear about.
Last of the day. I feel like I need a Rocky montage to get all worked up here. So as Scott mentioned, I've been working for the USGS for about 5 years now, and most of that has been focused on the Nisqually River Delta restoration. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. As you'll see, the title of my presentation is pretty broad, and I could talk about this stuff for hours and hours, but I've really tried to distill it down to a few examples of how we've used our post-restoration monitoring data creatively to assess the structure and function of the Nisqually River Delta. So for a little context, the Nisqually River Delta is an estuary, which is a wetland where the river meets the sea. It's comprised of these really complex, interrelated physical and biological components. So when I'm talking about the structural components of an estuary, I'm talking about things like channel morphology, sediment composition, water temperature, water salinity, vegetative community structure, invertebrate prey communities, and fish and wildlife that are using the estuary. When I'm talking about the functional components, I'm talking about aspects like how nutrients flow through the system, whether the marsh plain is resistant to erosion and sea level rise, how connected the tidal channels are and whether they're accessible for fish, whether the estuary provides refugia for fish and wildlife, how productive it is, and what the biodiversity is in the system. Okay, so the Nisqually River Delta is located about halfway between Olympia and Tacoma. It's the site of Billy Frank Jr. Nisqually National Wildlife Refuge. In 2009, the refuge and the tribe collaborated to remove a century-old dike and restore this about 300 hectares of this previously degraded marsh to tidal influence, and this resulted in a 50% expansion of tidal marsh habitat and wetland habitat in South Puget Sound. So this is an image of what the restoration area looked like before the restoration, and the grassy knoll over there is, I don't have a pointer, is the old dike line. And on the right, that's the degraded freshwater habitat, and it was overrun by a lot of invasive reed canary grass. And you can see that the tidal channels cannot penetrate past the dike line. And then this is what it looks like immediately after the restoration, and you can see now at high tide, the seawater can completely inundate the marsh plain. Just an aerial view, so again, this is immediately after the restoration. You can see that most of the restoration area is this degraded, subsided mudflat habitat where all the old reed canary grass and freshwater marsh was washed out to sea. And then just 5 years later, we can see a lot of vegetative regrowth. We can see that the marsh plain is starting to accrete sediment and raise an elevation relative to sea level. And it's moving towards a restoring trajectory. But how do we actually know what these structural and functional elements of the restored Nisqually Delta are doing? We need some sort of monitoring plan. So the success criteria we came up with are based off of Simonstad and Cordell's 2000 paper, looking at the opportunity, capacity, and realized function of the restoring delta. And this is because one of our main species of interest was the threatened juvenile, well, the Chinook salmon, because the juveniles used the estuarine habitat during their out-migration quite a bit. So opportunity potential is basically how much habitat was made available by the restoration. Foraging capacity is what prey resources are available in the restoration area. And then the realized function of the delta is whether or not this addition of habitat and prey actually benefits salmon in terms of whether they can access and grow from these resources. But on top of these three main criteria, we really wanted to take an integrated approach to our monitoring efforts. So we looked at all aspects of the restoring delta, from sediment to channel morphology to vegetation to invertebrates to actual fish and wildlife. So we asked questions like, is the elevation of the marsh plain increasing? What is water temperature and water salinity doing? What kind of plants are growing successionally after the initial disturbance? Are invertebrate prey colonizing the restoration area? And are birds and salmon using the restoring habitat? So I'm gonna give an example of each one of the success criteria, so opportunity, capacity, realized function. To start off with, in terms of opportunity potential, we looked at channel morphology. And we did this with a variety of remote sensing and empirical methods. So we measured LIDAR. We took LIDAR imagery. We flew aerial photographs. We tracked down the historic T-sheets. We measured channel cross-sections, and we also hand-digitized these channels in GIS using the LIDAR and the aerial imagery. So the top picture on the left, that is the hand-digitized channels from the historic T-sheets that were drawn circa 1878. And on the right is what the channels looked like about 2 years after the restoration in 2011. And what you can see is that the actual morphology of the channels is pretty similar even after the restoration area being diked and used for agriculture for 100 years. So that's pretty cool. And also, for when we actually measured the channel morphology in the field, we found that the channels after the restoration became deeper through time. So all that sediment that had been built up in the channels over time got washed away, and the tidal forces eroded out the channels through time to make them about as deep and similar in shape to the reference marsh, the previously unaltered marsh areas. But what does this mean functionally? So we really wanted to know whether juvenile salmon and other fish could access this habitat. And to do this, we did an inundation model. So the upper panels are the inundated area at mean tidal level. And the lower panels are the inundated area at mean high water. And on the left is before the dike was removed. And on the right is after the dike was removed. And what you can really see is above mean tidal level, so about mean high water, many paths open up across the delta. Fish no longer have to move all the way around to the north and then to the west to access those sites on the west side of the delta like McAllister Creek. They can traverse through the restoration area. So functionally, we can see that this restoration really opened up, really increased the accessibility and connectivity of the delta. Okay, prey resources, foraging capacity. So we measured the availability of terrestrial, aquatic, and benthic prey. We really wanted to examine these multiple environmental strata. I'm just gonna show you our terrestrial prey since we're short on time. We set fallout traps in the marsh plain adjacent to some of our restored channels. And what we saw was that even just 1 or 2 years after the restoration, flies were really the taxa that were colonizing this restoration area. And within 2 years, we had the same number of terrestrial invertebrate prey at the restoration area, which is outlined in that orange box, as in two of our reference marsh areas and in an older restoration area on the east side of the river. And the same is true when we looked at drift insects, so insects that were on top of the water column, which we sampled using a Newston net. Within a year or two, we saw lots of these dipterans, these flies floating on the surface of the water. Okay, but functionally, how does this transfer to energy availability for juvenile fish, for juvenile salmon? We ran some back-of-the-envelope calculations here where we basically multiplied the total available biomass in the restoration area by the energy density of the different prey taxa, and what we found was that the restoration area added about 1 million kilojoules of energy to the restoration area, and in layman terms, that equates to about 3,000 to 4,000 hamburgers worth of energy at any given time in the restoration area. Okay, so the final component here is the realized function of the system. Are fish actually accessing and benefiting from these added habitat and prey resources? The simplest way we can do this is by counting the fish in the channel. So every year the tribe goes out and they beach seine and they fike net these restoration areas and other habitats throughout the entire delta. And what they saw was in the first couple of years, yes, juvenile Chinook salmon were indeed using the restoration area at a level that was similar to reference marsh channels. The chum salmon, the juvenile chum salmon, not as much, but I cannot speak to why that would be, because I mostly focus on Chinook. We also looked at the diets. As I mentioned a few slides earlier, most of what we were seeing were flies in the drift samples and in our fallout traps, and this translated to the diets as well. So juvenile Chinook salmon in particular were really honing in on these additional terrestrial invertebrate dipteran prey. And especially in 2000 and 2012, 2 and 3 years after the restoration, most of their diets were comprised of flies in terms of total biomass. So to see whether this was resulting in actual increased growth, we looked at otoliths, which are a bone in the head of the fish, which grows tree rings, rings like a tree. So you can measure on a daily basis or over a specific time period how much a fish grew. And we found that growth in the restoration area was comparable to growth in the older restored habitat on the east side of the river and also in the reference marsh. But there was a lot more complex interactions going on here because growth is really determined by the density of fish in the channel and how much prey is there to begin with. So what the plot shows in the upper left is that when there's low prey and high fish densities, fish don't grow as well as if there's high prey availability and even if there's high fish densities. And then the plot in the lower right-hand corner shows residence time. So we saw that when channels had more fish in them, fish were less likely to spend a longer period of time using the estuary. Besides looking at empirical measurements of growth using otoliths or in some cases scales, we can model growth using bioenergetics models. So this is a mass balance equation. If anyone's ever been on a diet, it's kind of a calories in, calories out sort of deal, except for with fish, it's more complicated because their metabolism is also based on the water temperature that they're living in. So this is actually the end goal of my dissertation, is to come up with a spatially explicit bioenergetics model, which the animation on the left is the first iteration. And what we're finding is that the restoration area is actually has the highest growth potential out of any of the habitats. And that's probably due to the availability of those flies that are colonizing the surface, which are really energy-rich, abundant prey. Okay, so take-home message. We cannot stress to you enough the importance of long-term monitoring. I, in this presentation, because I was short on time, really focused on the first 3 years of data, but we have data through 2015, 2016, and we've actually encouraged the refuge to continue monitoring efforts on a 5 or 10 year basis into the future. And this is so important because you can do so much more with your data when you have a long-term data set. Another important lesson we learned was the importance of monitoring for both structure and function. Just because your system looks like a historic system after 10 years post-restoration doesn't mean that it's functioning the same way or that it's achieving a functional equivalency with an ideal target habitat. Also, thinking outside the box is really important. What can you do with your data? Besides what I've shown you here, we've run stable isotope analyses. We have colleagues who are running marsh accretion models to examine how resilient the restoration area and the reference marsh is to climate change. We've built some hydrological models. And the final lesson is consider scope and scale in your restoration project. Okay, and with that, I will thank my many partners and collaborators, and I will take questions.
Questions for Melanie?
Very loud. Very thorough job on your work there. It's nice to see that happen. Just curious if you saw any life history variants returning in the salmon that are utilizing the restoration.
Yes. From my understanding, and Chris Ellings might be the person who can answer this best. I don't know if he's still here. But there are... So we see life history variation primarily between wild versus hatchery Chinook. So Nisqually has a really big hatchery population, and those ones tend to just shoot straight through the delta, the estuary. They'll spend maybe 2 weeks there. This is what we observed in our otolith data. The wild Chinook exhibit way more life history variation. So they'll start trickling through as early as February or March. Some of them will stay around for as long as 2 or 3 months. Some of them will go directly to the offshore. And there is a smolt trap that's installed further upstream. And from my understanding, I think there's also a late season pulse of smolts that run through in June or July. So yeah, we do see life history variation. We don't have studies that are as detailed as like Dan Bottom studies in the Salmon River estuary, but that would be something really cool to do with our otolith data for sure.
Yes, hi. I have two questions. One is if you have taken into consideration land uses outside of the restoration area, like in the uplands, in the headwaters, what kind of impacts they may have on the restoration at the estuary. And the second one, have you taken into account sea level rise and climate change and how that may impact your restoration site?
Okay, I think I missed the first question. Is it, were you talking about upriver?
Upriver, what kind of land uses are taking place and how they can impact the estuary?
So the Nisqually River is actually relatively pristine. The Land Trust and the River Foundation and the tribe have done a really good job of reaching out to landowners, and there's easements, and it's really well protected. But so that is a major consideration. There's also restoration projects on the tributaries of the Nisqually, like the Moshel and the Ohop. So that has been taken into account. And then as far as sea level rise, there have been a few models run. There's a model called SLAM. So I think someone ran a SLAM model in 2005. And then one of Cy Simon's dad's students ran another SLAM model in 2015. And then Karen Thorne down in California ran a different kind of sea level rise model called a warmer model. So we have that. And then another collaborator is running something called a MEM model. But they're all basically doing the same thing. They're projecting how the marsh plain will respond to sea level rise. And the initial results are showing that the restoration area is really vulnerable to sea level rise. But the historic marsh appears to have some resilience because it's starting at a higher elevation, so it can really, it can hang on with that. There's this positive feedback cycle where vegetation traps sediment, raises the elevation, grows vegetation, traps sediment, raises elevation. So the historic marsh won't disappear completely over the next 100 years, is what these models are saying.